Welcome to A Contra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Contra AI. Today, we're diving deep into a novel that, well, it really holds a mirror up to South African history and personal moral failure with this unnerving precision. J.M. Coetzee's 1999 masterwork, Disgrace.
Oh, absolutely. Coetzee is, I mean, one of the giants, isn't he? Two-time Booker winner, Nobel Prize in 2003, and Disgrace. It's really a centerpiece of his later work, written and set at such a critical moment.
Exactly. The context here is just, it's everything.
Right.
1999, that's only 5 years after the official end of apartheid. And the novel engages so directly with those raw, unsettling power shifts, the anxieties, the guilt, you know, the whole atmosphere of the new South Africa.
You really do feel it coming off the pages.
Yeah.
And it was bound to be controversial, wasn't it? It got huge praise globally instantly. But back home, well, it drew significant criticism.
Right. Some figures, even within the ANC, felt it was too pessimistic, maybe defeatist.
Exactly. Especially how it depicts violence and this deep moral ambiguity without offering easy answers.
And Coetzee's refusal to give those easy outs, politically or morally, that's precisely what we want to unpack today. We're aiming to trace the really stunning downfall of the main character, Professor David Lurie, and look at what his personal humiliation might reveal about, well, historical reckoning, accountability, and maybe that painful search for real humility.
So let's meet David Lurie. He starts out as this figure of, you know, immense intellectual control and definite personal privilege. He's 52, teaches romantic poetry in Cape Town. But his life, it's marked by this profound emotional detachment. He kind of uses his intellect like a shield, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely. A shield against messiness, against real human connection. Mm. His life feels very transactional. He thinks he's solved his sexual needs with these weekly, quite cold visits to a prostitute, Soraya.
Right. He sees himself as above it all, refined, separate from the kind of, well, vulgar realities he lectures about.
But that carefully constructed control just shatters, doesn't it?
It does. When the arrangement with Soraya ends, his focus shifts almost immediately to a student, Melanie Isaacs. And David, characteristically, filters this through his professional lens. He sees the affair, which is deeply imbalanced, through his right of desire.
Like it's some sort of lyrical interlude, a gift from Eros, I think he calls it.
Exactly. He's casting her as a muse in his own little drama, not really seeing her as a person with her own agency.
The irony is just, wow, a professor of romantic poetry, idolizing beauty and high emotion, but completely incapable of genuine connection or apology. And when the complaint comes, that intellectual arrogance becomes his absolute downfall at the university hearing.
It really does. He admits the facts, yes, but he flatly refuses to perform the kind of repentance that the committee seems to demand. He sees the whole process as, well, a kind of modern administrative theater, a therapeutic charade, I think is his phrase.
But is that refusal truly about defending intellectual dignity? Or is it maybe the last gasp of an old kind of entitlement, an unwillingness to accept that his power came from a system that's frankly dissolving?
That's the core question, isn't it? The committee wants this public display of remorse, self-flagellation almost.
And he just scorns it.
He does. And if you think about the timing with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission happening in the background, The novel really pushes you to ask, what's the real difference between genuine moral acknowledgement and just saying sorry because the new rules say you have to? David picks stubborn pride, and that's it. His professional life is over. Public disgrace.
So, stripped of his job, his status, David retreats. He literally drives away from the city, away from that intellectual world he used to dominate. He heads out to the rural Eastern Cape, to his daughter Lucy's small holding. And this feels like the shadow of the new order really starting to fall on him personally.
And Lucy, she's such a contrast to him, isn't she? His uncomfortable mirror. She's grounded, pragmatic, a lesbian farmer, runs a dog kennel. She seems to have radically accepted the precariousness of the new South Africa. Her life is about physical work, necessity, not abstract theory.
Right. And the setup there on the farm, it's already complicated. Their safety, such as it is, seems tied up with their neighbor, Petrus.
Yes, Petrus. He starts as Lucy's helper, sort of, but he's rapidly becoming something else. An ambitious, kind of enigmatic black landowner. He really embodies those shifting power dynamics, the new economic realities taking shape right there on the ground.
And that setting, the Eastern Cape. Coetzee chairs it carefully, you feel.
Oh, absolutely crucial. It's a landscape loaded with history, generations of frontier conflict, racial tension. It's not some idyllic escape. It's the perfect charged backdrop for what happens next.
Because that fragile peace they have is just obliterated.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the novel's absolute core, wouldn't you say? The climax of powerlessness.
It's brutal. Three black men invade the farm. David is attacked. He's burned, locked in the bathroom, left completely broken physically and psychologically powerless. And while he's locked away, Lucy is gang raped. It's the crucible, as you said. It shatters every last illusion David had about control, about his place in the world. He's face to face with raw vulnerability, mortality.
And the aftermath. The conflict between father and daughter is just devastating. David instinctively reverts to the old ways. He wants the law, justice. He demands they report the rape.
He needs that structure, the formal retribution of the state. It's all he knows.
But Lucy.
Yeah.
She refuses.
Yeah.
Completely. She's almost chillingly unsentimental about it.
Yeah. She frames it not as this violation that demands outside justice, but almost as a consequence of being there, of living in that place at that time.
Suggesting reporting it won't help. Might even make things worse, saying it's the price one has to pay for staying on.
That line is just, it hangs there. It's her stark choice. Pragmatic acceptance, however bitter, over what she sees as futile retribution.
And that's the moment David seems to fully grasp his own obsolescence, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says he realizes he's a creature of the old regime, of the old South Africa. His whole framework is useless here. He's displaced.
Utterly. And her acceptance goes even deeper into something almost unbearable. She finds out she's pregnant from the assault. And she decides to keep the child. She sees it as part of bearing the consequences of living in this new, violent reality.
Which leads to her final accommodation, the one David finds completely horrific.
Yes. She enters into this incredibly complex and, frankly, deeply humiliating arrangement with Petrus. She essentially agrees to become his dependent, a kind of wife in a traditional non-romantic sense. She has to cede a large part of her land to him in return for his protection. It's stability, yes, but at the cost of her autonomy. It feels like total surrender.
Total capitulation.
Yeah.
And David just can't watch it. He flees again.
Back to Cape Town. He makes this one last fumbling attempt at atonement. He visits Melanie Isaac's family. But his apology is just pathetic, disjointed. It brings no relief because he no longer has the power or the status to make an apology meaningful. His words are hollow, no.
So if legal action fails and intellectual apology fails, the only path left seems to be through what? Physical service. Humiliation.
It seems so. He goes back to the Eastern Cape and finds this strange, new, very humbling role, volunteering at Bevshaw's animal clinic. His job is mainly helping to euthanize unwanted dogs. He becomes the dog man.
His descent, it feels absolutely critical to his arc.
It is. Moving from that detached intellectual high ground to this very basic, grim service. Caring for these creatures who offer nothing back in terms of status or recognition. It's like a stripping away of the ego. He even says it himself. More and more, I feel like a dog. A dog wearing clothes and standing on its hind legs, trying to be a man.
He's deliberately putting himself on that elementary level, as he calls it. But Okay, let's push on this a bit. Does finding this kind of grace among animals, does it actually absolve him of his debts to Melanie or even Lucy? Is it Ketsy maybe letting him find a sort of convenient, non-human way out of his political and personal responsibility?
That's a really sharp question. Because the grace he finds, if you can call it that, it's not comfortable. It's not absolution in a neat sense. It feels more like painful resignation. And it all culminates in that final, quiet, absolutely gut-wrenching scene. David has grown attached to this one lame dog. He's been trying to save it. And in the end, he brings that dog to the clinic to be euthanized.
He gives it up. He sacrifices his own emotional connection for, what, the dog's dignity? The release from suffering?
It feels like his final act of surrender. Giving up control, giving up attachment, accepting his role, accepting shame, maybe.
Kouassi writes, he is giving it up, this miserable, sully dog, this dog that he's been trying to save, this dog that is his. It's the final letting go.
Yeah. Accepting this role as a servant to suffering, to death, almost, humbly.
So, okay, let's try to pull back now and weave these threads together. What are the big takeaways here? Well, first, there's this undeniable theme of exploitation, right? David's personal exploitation of Melanie using his power.
Mm-hmm.
It mirrors the larger historical exploitation that clearly fuels the resentment, the violence he eventually suffers.
Absolutely. And that links directly to the central idea of disgrace versus grace. The novel seems to argue that real grace isn't found in status or reputation. It's found in the complete, often agonizing acceptance of shame, of humility. David has to start at ground level. with nothing, as the book says.
And the dogs, their symbolism is just brilliant. They represent vulnerability, the disposable, but they also create this space away from human ego and politics where maybe some kind of genuine basic compassion can emerge. David only finds meaning when he stops trying to be that man of intellect.
And then there's that terrible tension between justice and compromise. Lucy's choice just blows up conventional ideas of justice, the very ideas David clings to. She settles for this incredibly difficult, unequal, pragmatic truce with Petrus. It shows that survival in this new, harsh reality might demand compromises that are, well, morally messy, even humiliating.
And what makes it so powerful, I think, is how Coetzee traps us inside David's head. His flawed perspective, his unreliability. We're forced as readers to wrestle with all this ambiguity. He offers no easy answers, no simple political messages.
None at all. The strength is in that precision, that unflinching moral questioning. That's why it's a masterpiece. It stays with you.
It really forces a confrontation with historical trauma, suggesting that maybe real reckoning isn't just about grand public gestures.
But maybe about these deeply personal, incredibly painful compromises that strip away privilege and leave you, well, utterly vulnerable.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acacha Foundation.